The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And hello, everybody, and welcome to this special Space Show program. We are live today on Saturday, so just a reminder, toll-free lines and chat and email are all fine on Saturday. When you hear this program replay tomorrow, Sunday, November 6th, it is a replay program. We'll be happy to take your email questions and comments, but don't use the toll-free line or chat. We won't be there. And this is, again, necessitated by my heading off to Grand Forks, North Dakota to teach for the week at the university there. So for today, if you would like to call the program, our toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. And the email for the show is dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and thespaceshow@gmail.com. And chat users have Space Show Chat, all one word. And don't forget to check out our newsletter, which is on the website, thespaceshow.com. It's updated every Monday and as necessary during the week. All of our coming events are on the program there. You can see what's in store for the Space Show. All programs are archived as MP3 since January, and they are being podcast. So you're welcome to download them, copy them, circulate them, and give them to your friends. You just can't edit the shows, have us say things that we never intended to say, or do anything commercial with them, and do anything else that works for your convenience to listen to the programs and spread the word. Visit the Space Show store when you can and let me know what you think of the upgrades. Give me some feedback on whether you think we should have a new Space Show forum. You can check out the questions on the survey at the top of the website newsletter. And then remember that our Deep Space Communication Project is now underway. Details will be on the website very, very soon. You can get them from me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. The first message goes November 30th. That is the Space Show message. And after that, it will be every other month with listeners competing to see who wins versus Space Show assigning a message to someone. Excuse me. And then also, of course, that great Gigadial service for our podcasting with Andrew. Check it out at gigadial.net. And then the Space Show is a registered trademark for Dr. David Livingston. That is me. And today, back with us, after just a short departure from the Space Show, we are honored to have Rick Tumlinson join us again. Rick, to me, is the space visionary. I can't think of anybody who puts that vision out there more eloquently, more powerfully, and more as a motivating force than Rick has been doing over the years and still does. And if you had been at the Space Frontier Foundation meeting in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago, you would know firsthand why I say that about Rick. And his full bio is on the newsletter on the website. Rick has been around the space world. He is really knowledgeable. He is an authority. But what that bio doesn't say is that the guy has an enormous amount of courage. He has an enormous amount of integrity that he brings to the table. He's one of the very few people on the planet who walks his talk, believes his walk, believes his talk. He brings honor to the space world. And I think that that's the best thing that I can say in introducing Rick and bringing him back to the show. So welcome back to the Space Show, Rick. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. We got a quick meeting like this. I got to tell you, I'll just keep coming back as long as you keep saying stuff like that. I mean, you know, once a week would be a nice shot of that. I really appreciate it, David.
Thank well, you. It, you know, you've earned it. What can I say? I'm not BSing or putting any lies out there. I mean, this is who you are. And you know what? If space didn't exist in our consciousness, you'd probably be out there finding a way to create it. So, and, you know, maybe your creation would be a hell of a lot better than what we've got. I don't know. speaking of your creation at the Space Frontier Foundation meeting, you did have an opportunity to talk about how we're going to go back to our moon, to the moon, and you know, why we should be doing things in space, and about space settlement and all sorts of issues. And, you know, if you could get the front page news and on CNN and all the different stations and Fox and everyone, and you could have the ear of the president instead of some of the people that probably do have his ear, I do think we'd be a lot better off. Tell us about what happened from your perspective at the conference, the discussions on the going back to the moon architecture, space uh-huh. settlement, the vision. I mean, we discussed it all at the conference.
Yeah, by the way, if I had all of those access to the president and that sort of media, my message would be you know, give America a chance. Give Americans a chance. Because we are neglecting, our government is completely neglecting the excitement, the intelligence, the creativeness, the innovation, all of those sorts of things that are out there in the American people when it comes to opening space, and instead playing an inside game with a few select aerospace companies and a just a side note, we'll come back to this, I'm sure, but Mr. Griffin took his failed right out of the box plan for how to go back to the moon to the Hill last week. Was basically told, no way, no way, it's not going to happen. Apparently at one point even lamented that, well, America can't go back to the moon on its own. We're going to need foreign partners to do it. In fact, that was even picked up by Jay Leno, which is insulting to the American people, because that skips right over what is offered out there, by these incredible people in the new space world, you know, from the Rutan to the Elon Musk to the Jeff Bezos to all these other people that you and others talk about so much. And it's really insulting. It is as if they cannot grasp what is really happening right in front of them. Now, speaking of right in front of them, that's what we tried to do at the Space Frontier Conference last week, was to put it right in front of audiences and people. And we had a great gathering of people. You know, David, you were there. It was an exciting, fun group. You know, we're in a weird situation. We have had to scramble a bit due to some major changes that happened, so that the people putting on the conference had only had about 3 months to do it. And I give them a huge salute. Krista Paradiso, who you had on with me prior to the conference, not only survived alive, not only didn't kill her fiancé, or anybody on the staff, but instead triumphed and put on one heck of an event. And I want to salute Krista and her team. We had a wide variety of speakers, a wide variety of attendees, and you know, the issues of the return to the moon were addressed, you know, business issues. We had people there from the FAA. We had many of the new space company representatives there, and as usual, of course, a lot of the actual work the conference was going on, as you saw, I'm sure, in the couches and in the hallways, which is one of the prime functions of the foundation conferences. They are, in fact, not so much just conferences, because everybody has conferences, as they are sort of the fire around which the various tribes of the frontier movement can gather. And we were very inclusive. We had George Whitesides there from the National Space Society. Bob Zubrin was there. So it was a very good event overall.
Why do you think the government is putting the kibosh on the American creativity and genius that we could do if we got turned loose into an entrepreneurial environment to create space. Why are we so boycotted out of this system?
I think the simple answer, and I'll, you know, I've said before the word paradigm is a word you shouldn't toss around lightly, but in this field that we're in, it is actually and very, very clearly a paradigm shift that's going on. And I think a part of it is the sort of social psychology wherein the old paradigm just can't even recognize the new at first. And I think that's something that's going on. There is a real almost groupthink that is happening. You know, NASA, I am just amazed, and I wrote in a Space News op-ed that if NASA got the budget for this silly program of theirs funded by Congress, that I myself would actually join NASA, because it is a place where miracles come true. I mean, they designed a system which, you know, 40 years after the Apollo system was designed, was basically an incremental improvement over it. You know, instead of three seats, this one's got four or five. It is basically Apollo Redux, and it absolutely demonstrates no leadership whatsoever. It doesn't demonstrate any real pioneering spirit. It is instead, given the presentations I've seen, what I call PowerPoint pioneering. It's meant to get contracts. It's meant to get money flowing in certain directions, but it has no basis in any plausible reality, especially if we are talking about a sustainable frontier approach to opening space. So they just don't get it, number one. Number two, why rock the boat? These people know each other. A lot of badge shifting goes on between the aerospace companies and NASA. A lot of feedback round and round in a big loop between them. And they create this groupthink mentality that this is the way to do something. The irony is, of course, it shows no learning. It shows no learning whatsoever. This is the same organization that several years after the terrible Challenger accident did a repeat with Columbia based on not the exact same things happening, but the same sorts of things happening as far as the system was concerned. This is the same organization that is now learning nothing from the space station and space shuttle programs. We have to see real pioneering and innovation occur at our space agency, or they will frankly become irrelevant. And that's the real danger that I don't think they realize, is that they are pushing themselves into irrelevancy, that they are, by ignoring what's going on out there in the American public and what is possible in the new space industry, they are driving themselves further and further away from being anything near a leading-edge innovation-producing organization. So we have to get that changed. We have to – I'm hoping that this program that Mr. Griffin rolled out, which I refer to as the Planetary Society program, because it is something that he had presented in a paper a year or two ago to the Planetary Society, which, by the way, has been an organization that has been against civilians being in orbit or being in space for a long time. Lou Friedman, the head of the Planetary Society, sat next to me at the dais testifying in front of Senator McCain and others in the Senate. And if you go back and read his testimony, although grudgingly admitting that maybe we should send some people into space, absolutely was against the idea of anybody who wasn't a government employee going.
He was on the space show earlier this year. People can hear him talk on the program.
He is he's an interesting fellow, and you know, I admired his predecessor, Carl Sagan, although Carl Sagan, up until just right before the end of his life, was against humans in space. Carl did a lot for opening people up to the concept of the cosmos and the universe, and I acknowledge and honor that. But That side of the world has been against humans in space for a long time, and I don't think they've really changed their stripes that much. This program that was laid out by Griffin was designed to get us to the moon quickly and cheaply. And when I say cheaply, I'm using a relative term. Cheaply compared to other more expensive inside NASA, inside aerospace programs to go to the moon. Not cheaply like you and I who live and work every day out in the real world would understand it. And so they created a system that involved throwing everything away. It's amazing. They call it Apollo on steroids. I think of it as Apollo ugly, fat, and old. I mean, it's just recycled, and it does nothing to create a sustainable frontier.
There's a space show listener, and he's been on the program, but he also does incredible space news research. His name is Rick Sterling. I don't know if you've ever come across him or seen his emails or not. Just since yesterday alone, I have 4 emails where he does his esoteric space news research with different URLs to different news services talking about China, their space program, their dedication to going to the moon before we go to the moon, and all sorts of things coming from the Chinese space program. I mean, I don't understand how we are so asleep at the wheel. It's beyond me.
You know, it's interesting. What I'm afraid of is, this would be a good thing on one side and a bad thing on another, that China would do that and go to the moon first. Let's keep in mind, all those made in China things that everybody out there is buying, that money is going somewhere. And the spirit of Chen Ho, who was the admiral, the Chinese admiral who led the magnificent voyages of exploration that China had in the 1500s or so, or 1400s, that spirit is coming back. And they're feeling bold. They're feeling confident. They have incredible cultural pressures, not just to find new resources, but to find new psychological outlets, to aim the spirit of their people in a direction that doesn't involve them thinking too much about the form of government they're under. They have all these pressures on them and all these possibilities made by the fact that we buy Chinese, Walmart's buying Chinese, everybody's buying Chinese stuff, and all our cash is flowing into their bank accounts, that it's money they want to do something with. So I think that they will go outward. It's been, within 1 year, they went from 1 to 2 taikonauts. I think that the plans are in the works, if not already under construction, for an orbital facility, and on and on. And by the way, those people who advocate handing the space station to the Russians must understand that, in effect, if they hand it to the Russians, they are indeed handing it to the Chinese as well. Because the day we close the hatch and pull out of there, the Russians are going to make a deal with the Chinese. And then there's an interesting scenario going on. The irony, I won't use the word irony again here. The point that we have to keep in mind is that the way this time for us to compete with a central command economy, socialist government's approach to opening space is not to match it with our own central command economy socialist government approach to space. NASA is not going to successfully be able to answer the challenge of China, period. China's challenge to us can only be answered by enrolling, catalyzing, and enabling the new space industry and those parts of the traditional space industry that are willing to innovate and try to do things in a new way. That's the only way we can do it. The way we win is when we act like the ideals that we have endowed in ourselves in this nation, and that is individual rights, free enterprise, a partnership between the private and public sectors that is designed to push and promote the capabilities of each individual citizen.
God,
that's how we do it.
How long has it been since we've acted like that on anything in this country?
off and on, we've had some bright spots. I do point at the internet. At the internet, we had an architecture, a system that was designed for government use that was handed over in an almost laissez-faire way to the private sector. And the private sector has done incredible things with it. Computer technology, very similar, handed over to the private sector. And the private sector, and I mean all of its forms, university and commercial, has done awesome things with it. I think I mentioned a few shows ago when I was on that my mother is now sending me pictures over the internet, has become completely comfortable using a computer and that kind of thing. And it's transformed American lives. So there are examples, and that one's huge and right in front of us. They didn't overly tax it. They didn't put a huge amount of restrictions on it. They just allowed it to go. And that's what we have to do with the new space companies.
And for American people, what's the best thing, the most effective thing we can do to help make that happen? Something needs to be done.
I think, my obvious first answer is joining and supporting organizations like the Space Frontier Foundation. There aren't many of them, by the way. There are organizations out there that people can join that are space organizations, but there are very, very few space organizations that have a real direction and that hue to this frontier approach to space.
That's how I was going to say that. You have to have discernment because not all these space organizations have the same agenda or the same focus or the same drive. So if this is where you want to put your time and effort and your money, use some discernment as you're going through the list of which of the really good organizations to join.
Right. I would say there are only maybe two or three or four to me that are valuable in getting this pointed message. There are other organizations out there that are in, are space supporters. National Space Society is a space supporting organization. Even the Planetary Society does a good job of supporting planetary exploration, the sort of voyeuristic type stuff, but which is astronomy and those things, which are great things to support. Of the organizations that really roll up their sleeves and are working to open the frontier so that you and I can go, vanishingly small. The Space Access Society, which is almost a one-man organization who does an incredible job with Henry Vanderbilt. There is the in Arizona there. There is ProSpace, led by, I think, Mark Slater and a few other folks in Washington. I urge people to sign up to ProSpace. If you ever want to get really hands-on, go to Washington, be a part of their March Storm, where you're going door-to-door and actually talking to people in Congress about your concerns. And obviously the Space Frontier Foundation. The foundation, I think, is going through a renaissance right now. We're more organized than we've ever been. We've got our new newsletter out called the New Space News, which, by the way, is getting, I was just reading today, emails coming in from readers giving us kudos for this new little magazine, online magazine.
How do people subscribe to that if they're not yet members of the foundation, or how do they find out about it?
You go to the Space Frontier Foundation website, and I think it's spacefrontierfoundation.org.
Right.
And I think you'll be led to the right page for signing up. It's a great little magazine that brings you different ideas and different stories. Some of them, are way outside of anything you're going to read in any space journals or anything. And it brings them together with little, basically just links, a one-sentence blurb and a link that takes you to a story that's relevant or somebody's press release about trying a new motor or forming a new partnership. But again, the main point that people have who support the frontier need to digest, really get a taste and a feel for, and then begin to bring out and to say and to create in the world is this concept that our goal in space is settlement. Don't be afraid to use the word settlement. I think I may have mentioned in the last interview with you that I was very upset that certain people had been afraid to use that word settlement in Washington. And I think that was a great deal of timidity, and I think it's a misjudging and a disservice, even to some of their own members, that they wouldn't, because the word settlement, the word permanence, these are words that mean something. And if at the very, very, very top level, at the presidential, congressional level, we were able to somehow create permanence and settlement as the driver for opening space, everything else that trickles down from that begins to then feed into that end goal or end result, and you get a very, very different approach than we see coming out of NASA. You know, what we the president said in his speech, he used the word extended presence, number one. That was a real trap, because that means, well, we just want to go and hang out longer than before. Extended is very relative. Settlement is not a relative term. And, you know, yeah, these are just words. Oh, these are just words. They don't mean anything. But there are, you know, there are a few words written on a piece of parchment that you can go to our nation's capital and read. They're called the Declaration of Independence. And it's just a few words. Those words determine the fate of the greatest nation on earth. And if we can begin to share a common language and imbue that language with real action, activity, and persistence, we can change what we're doing in space. Settlement is the key. Settlement is what it's all about. You don't have kind of settlement. You can have a kind of extended stay in space. You can kind of go and visit. You can kind of go out there and kind of explore. But you don't have kind of settlement. It's like pregnancy. You know, it's either A or B. You know, so I urge people to contact their representatives. Go see them. They love it. I mean, go see them. Go into their offices when they're in their districts. Go in there and say, I am very disillusioned with what NASA is doing right now. I want to see a space program for the United States that is aimed at permanent settlement, that brings us the hope and possibilities and resources that we might be able to get if we actually went out and opened space for me and my children. And I want you to do that, ma'am or sir, by working with organizations like the Space Frontiers Foundation and others to put together an agenda that leads to the private sector getting out there, working with the government in a way that enables people to go and live in space.
Have you ever thought of writing a sample letter to your congressman on this thing to put it up on the foundation's website or to get it out there for people to sort of model? Because you say it so much better than so many of us are going to say it.
You know, it's an excellent idea, David, and I appreciate that, and I'll carry that back into the foundation. We should definitely do something like that. I am, by the way, pondering my second book right now, which is tentatively going to be called The Manifesto for the Space Frontier. And it's just going to be a very short book, not a pamphlet, but not quite a full, you know, 400-page tome, where I want to lay out some of these basic principles. Because I think we do get carried away at times. Engineers get caught up in engineering, and politicians get caught up in politicking and things like that. And, you know, this is more than something that's just about a business plan. It's about a goal. And forgive me for staying on the subject for a minute, but I think it is the core issue right now. And, you know, if you have a settlement-driven agenda, it's like, you know, if you've decided that you're going to paint the Mona Lisa, and, you know, you've decided that, then you end up with a painting that, for good or bad, at least begins to approximate Mona Lisa, the person you're painting. If, however, you have a decision that you're going to sort of paint somebody or just paint something, then you'll end up with something completely different. And every decision you make, the brushes you use, the colors you use, the canvas you use, the medium, everything is different. So, again, let's go back to settlement. Let's look at what enables settlement and what does enable settlement. Well, that partnership I mentioned between the private and public sector enables settlement. And it's everything from the tax structure to the way the business environment is set up to the way that NASA and our government as a whole contracts. You know, we had a discussion with several of the new space firms the day before our regular conference, and we talked about the military side of things. And pro or con, you know, whether you're for or against the military, it's interesting if you look back historically that there has been an ongoing exchange of technology and ideas and financial support from the beginning of flight, from the beginning of days of aviation. There has been an interaction between the private uses of the air and the military uses of the air that has resulted in major capabilities and advancements for both sides. And what I found interesting as we began to examine the subject was that there were only two partners in that relationship in aviation. And you would have situations where the military aircraft would evolve into passenger aircraft and vice versa, such as the 747, the various the DC-3, others that came from directly or indirectly military needs and requirements. Well, what happened in space was that a third party showed up. At the very beginning of our endeavors in space, a third party showed up when it came to the human side of things, called NASA. And NASA interjected itself, or was injected, between this interface between the military and private sectors, and NASA took on the role of being the designated human spaceflight organization. And thus, the interface between the public and private sectors in its purest form, as it was going on back and forth between the military and the private sector, was subverted. And we ended up, losing the chemistry that had occurred there. If we can, in the broader sense of government now, moving away from the military, reinvigorate, maybe even take human spaceflight out of NASA, maybe we just decide that it's the private sector that is going to take on these sorts of things. Let's look at, different ways of doing things like that and see what we can come up with.
We need to take a break, but I have a question I want to work in before we do that, and it's from Smith in Montreal, Canada. And he says, many of us outside the United States want to see space and its frontier open up, just like you talk about. However, we don't seem to be part of the process because the government-to-government programs don't seem committed to opening up a frontier or to doing anything in space or to seeing us here in Canada, for example, play a critical role in going back to the moon or going on forward with something in space. And we shouldn't be excluded just because we don't live within the borders of the United States. When I look at the heavy lift architecture that they're planning to do from the shuttle, I see only NASA big fat government programs supporting it and never seeing anything that commercial companies, regardless of their border, will ever be able to support or sustain. What can we do when we live outside the United States but are as equally committed to the vision as that which you are talking about on the space show today, yet writing letters to people in Canada doesn't seem to be where the action is, and Americans in Congress barely pay attention to what Americans write about, let alone a Canadian? Any thoughts, please?
I tell you what, let's come back after your break and spend some serious time on the international side of things. Because I do admit that sometimes having these sorts of discussions, I am neglectful of talking about and to our friends outside of the United States. It's very easy for us here to get trapped into that bilateral discussion between the American people and our government. And you're right, it's a much, much bigger picture. So we should hopefully, if we can do that, David, come back and really talk about the global, international implications of creating a more prosperous future, a hopeful future. Something that you and I recently delved into with Ms. Marks Hubbard, and maybe kind of move into that realm.
Okay.
And away so much from the U.S.
Because if we can bring allies in from around the world to help us with this, there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing that. We certainly shouldn't be excluding them, even if our stupid government excludes them.
Oh, absolutely. And again, my tendency at times is to speak to my government because that's the one I can influence. So that's the one I have the illusion of being able to influence.
That's better clarified.
Right. However, I will mention that I just formed with this wonderful fellow, Baron Soka, the International or the Institute for Space Law and Policy in Washington. And our institute's first task going out of the bag is to take on the ITAR regulations, which are very, very heinous, very, very limiting and self-destructive to the United States, and also putting up, I call it the new Iron Curtain, because it puts up barriers between Americans and our friends and partners in Canada and other nations. Right out of the bag, it's one of the things we're going to take on. It's definitely a David and Goliath fight, but I think it's one that's worth fighting because space knows no borders. Space knows no boundaries. And those of us in the new space industries who want to open space, I have found to a person, are completely open and interested and excited about being able to work with people in other nations. And it's that kind of interaction, which is just an extension of the sort of thing I was talking about let the people do it here in America. It's just an extension of that when you begin bringing in people from around the world to solve these different issues. And in fact, we had Vladimir Sheremetnikov, who was one of the people who worked on Sputnik and worked with us on the Mir deal when we were working on trying to save the Mir with the Russians, was at our conference as well. And we were talking a little bit about that issue that... To use a very scientific word, it totally sucks that I could sit down and have an idea for something that might be a very cheap way of doing something in space, but maybe I want to fly a little probe to the moon to look for platinum metals on the lunar surface. And the cheapest way to do that right now, while the new space companies are growing, it would be to hitch a ride on a Russian rocket. But then the conversation stops because I can't have that discussion with them without spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and months to go into a process, this Byzantine process, to be allowed to talk to these people about something that is not military in any way, but is simply a way of exploring and finding out what the resources of space are. It's a killer, especially when you're dealing with new space companies that don't have a lot of money. They don't have the legal staffs. They don't have the budgets for working their way through this system that the large aerospace companies and those who are in place have. So what you've got is a barrier to entry in the field of international space activities that has been is certainly not being overly fought, shall we say, by some of the aerospace companies, because it does keep out the lean, mean, smaller machines of new space enterprise.
Let's go to the break or we'll never take it. I will say that Baron is helping me recreate the RTM legal panel here on the space show on December 6th. So
that'll be great.
Baron, Rosanna, Jim, and Wayne are going to all be on, and we're going to be doing property rights. I'm sure we'll get into ITAR, although we do have two ITAR programs coming up. It's a major problem, but we'll do the break or we'll never get to it. So everybody stay where you are. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Our guest today, Rick Tumlinson.
The Space Show thanks its listeners and sponsors for their support. Having a spacefaring society and culture is not only important, it's crucial for humanity. It is also a large undertaking for everyone involved in this mission, and the Space Show is no exception. So join with us by visiting www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Please make a contribution which will help us in continuing to bring you our programming and services, all free of charge. The Space Show also has available opportunities for advertising and sponsorship on air, the archived programs, the newsletter, and the website. For information, contact Dr. Livingston at drspace@thespaceshow.com or 415-435-6018. Again, The Space Show thanks you for listening and for your support.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back to The Space Show, and today we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Visionary himself for space. I wish you were running NASA. I wish you were president, Rick. Damn.
Now that's... Okay, we're drifting into science fiction.
Well, all of it's science fiction because you have integrity. So, anyway, our guest is Rick Tumlinson, and, you know, I've said many, many times on the air, but for new listeners, writing a doctoral dissertation can get downright gloomy at times, especially when you have so much politics and infighting among your dissertation committee that want to pull you this way, that way, which way, and every way. And I used to keep focused on your speeches and comments from foundation meetings to keep the vision and the inspiration alive when I wanted to just go string up and wring necks of my advisors and then run like hell. There's a lot to say for inspiring people and having vision, and I don't downplay that a bit. But focusing on Smith's note from Montreal in the international component, have at it.
Well, I think it is important we understand that space is a frontier for everybody. It's not a frontier for one nation. It's not a frontier for one sector of our society, the government or industry. It is a frontier for everyone. It is a blank slate, or a canvas upon which any one of us has the right, and I believe also the responsibility of painting our own vision. And because of that, it is incumbent on us, those of us who care, to make sure that the pathways of communication and the pathways of enablement or whatever you want to call it, between all of us on the planet stay open. I personally, I'll give you the one caveat. I am not thrilled by seeing a socialist communist government in the form of the Chinese government kicking open the hatch so widely. But then again, by the same token, there is this sort of phenomena that when people actually get beyond their borders and establish themselves in another new world, shall we say, they have a tendency to kick back at the old. So with any luck, if the Chinese government should establish some sort of colonies or settlements beyond the earth, maybe those settlers after a while will decide that this concept called democracy is something worth embracing. Beyond that, however, I think that the idea of all of us working together wherever possible, however possible, is an absolute must. We need to get people out there. Let them decide what they're going to do when they get there. But let's get humanity off the planet. I want to see the first of, you know, so many different kinds of people walking on the moon, walking on Mars, building and opening a habitat or a hotel or an industrial facility in free space. I want to see the first of all kinds of people. You know, I want to see the first woman on the moon. I want to see the first child born off the planet who looks back at the Earth and thinks of it as another world. So it is very important that we all work together. When it comes to how do you influence your own governments, that gets into the nuances of each political system. I think writing about things, getting them published, getting them out there, being as loud as possible. Governments absolutely, almost inevitably and always are responsible eventually and over time to the squeakiest wheels. And if you can make your movement in your country the squeaky wheel, you will get attention over time. It's a very frustrating. I mean, look, our Space Frontier Foundation was founded in 1988 with three of us. It has taken forever to even be allowed to be engaged in a large and meaningful way in the game. Even now, our fight is tremendous, yet now and then we can call attention to things. We can make certain points and get things across. In a way that is heard by a wider audience. And what I found interesting here is that it's getting confusing now because we will hear our own rhetoric or I will hear my own words coming back at me from other people. I've heard them here on your space show voiced by other people now that were things that the foundation or I or members of the foundation were saying 15 years ago. And they're being said as if they're new. Actually, as frustrating as that may be, if you're a little egotistical and want to own stuff, in the larger sense, it's a sign that you're starting to break through. My point is, to our friend in Canada, to any of our friends around the world, is start making noise. Start now making noise. And make a concerted noise. Make a noise that aligns. You know, go... I have no problem if somebody wants to go to the Space Frontier Foundation website and start using some of our materials and some of our ideas and, you know, go start your own Space Frontier Foundation in your country. Our charter is not the National Space Frontier Foundation. We are not the U.S. Space Frontier Foundation. Our rhetoric may occasionally go that way, again, because this is our home and this is who we can interact with. And try and change, I would have very little luck changing the mind of a parliamentarian in Canada or Great Britain, for example, let alone here. I would urge, I mean, we've just added our first few Japanese members, you know, that may turn into sort of, I don't know whether we're going to call it a chapter or a separate, you know, the Space Venture Foundation of Japan or whatever. I encourage that, and I think it's important. Activism knows no boundaries.
In earlier years at Mars Society conferences, I would hear criticism of Bob's unique Mars vision for the use of the word frontier, and I would hear the criticism from people coming from Canada and Europe because their concept of frontier isn't anywhere as close to what we in America think of with a frontier or our frontier settling experience of the Old West and moving westward and manifest destiny and all of that. Do you see the word frontier being an obstacle on the international level?
No, I see it as being an opportunity. If you have no experience with something, the first time you get to dance with it is an opportunity to create it for yourself. I think that... a frontier can be, you know, you can use as a model technologies, you can use as a model ideologies, you can use as a model all sorts of cultural changes, and you know, the frontier of that was the Cartesian revolution, the Galilean, that was a frontier. It was a definitely a paradigm shift. There are definitely, the Chinese, let's use them again, had a frontier orientation at one point or another. Every culture can embrace the concept of a frontier. And if we have to, if it helps to remove it from the American, North American experience in particular, with all its connotations, then let's do so. Let's consider it anew. Let's reinvent that concept. So it is a human ideal, because it is, even in North America, it was people from all of those nations who came here and made this frontier viable. So let's look at that in space. How does that work? Well, what it means is that, by the way, even within the American system, you know, this is not a unique challenge to the Europeans or others. As I said at the very beginning of this program, our own system here in America does not grasp the concept of frontier. Our own government system, NASA itself, doesn't grasp the concept of frontier. So this idea that you know, this is something unique to Europeans or Canadians, etc., is actually, you know, I understand where the rhetoric is maybe a little more upfront, because our space agency, at least, you know, will put together propaganda that seems to sound like they're saying we're going to open the frontier, but in the end, they're not. So I would tell people, imagine a future. What future do you want? Do you want a future of shrinking resources, more and more government control, a more and more damaged biosphere, less and less opportunity to dream, a world in which the temptation to climb into electronic false realities, to basically cyber yourself into a world of ones and zeros that simulates a reality, is a better choice than actually dealing with the world, a world where the rapid acquisition of material goods becomes the way that you sort of feel that hollow feeling in yourself, which never really actually gets filled. Is that the future you want? Or do we want a future where the horizon is opening rather than narrowing, where rather than worrying about, I've got mine, you can't have it, worrying about how badly the climate in my country is going to change as the global warming kicks into gear, we can begin to look at a future where we are transforming the planet, where we are taking the pressure off of this precious, precious jewel we call Earth, where we are giving our children a future that's exciting to wake up to, where a child in any nation on Earth can look up into the sky and see little lights up there, or see lights on the moon, or have just seen a program about the first habitats and settlements on Mars, or the habitats being constructed out in the asteroid belt by people who are just like them. That's an exciting future for that child, those children, to understand that what we are about as human beings, regardless of nation, regardless of religion, regardless of where we were born or our social circumstances, what we are about as human beings is to protect this world and expand it outward. That is a universal concept, and that is a very powerful concept that has yet to be grasped. And frankly, I think in an evolutionary sense, looking at the great sweep of human history, the time to grasp it is right now. So everybody listening to this show can make themselves a messenger. Everybody listening to the show can actively promote and push and develop these concepts in their own mind that fit their own culture, their own country. Reach back, everybody's country, everybody's culture has examples where people have stepped forth with vision, where people have stepped forth and offered hope and opportunity. Every country does. Look at those examples, apply them to this vision of space, and get yourself involved and get off your couch and go do something.
Do you think it does any good when people from another country write letters to Mike Griffin or to our people in Congress or our space people supporting and urging us to move forward on this and asking to participate?
Not greatly. Unfortunately, not greatly. And again, you know, as you just mentioned, we have to be careful in our language. You know, if somebody is writing Mike Griffin a letter saying, we want to, you know, we want you guys to open, to go out and open space, well, that could be read a thousand different ways. Anybody writing to anybody in their government, space agencies or whatever, should say that we want you to enable the human settlement of space. We want you to enable the private sector to get involved in opening space. We want you to change what you're doing. Change it. It hasn't worked. and change it to this new approach. But I don't think people from other countries writing to a high-level, yet nonetheless bureaucrat, like a person like Mike Griffin, who's a decent fellow and trying to do a job that he sees within his own realm as being what he has to do, although I completely disagree with some of his ways of doing it, I don't think that's as useful as going for the brain. Going for the brain in your country. Go for the decision makers. You know, writing somebody who is following orders and telling them to do something is different than changing the orders. And what we have to do is change the orders at the level of the leaders of our nation. Now, let's be really clear and understand that several nations are engaged in the right sorts of activities, maybe without the right context, but there are several nations that are sending probes to the moon right now. The Indians, the Japanese are sending a probe to an asteroid to bring back a sample. We have some very interesting missions going on. And one way to influence your nation's space agenda is to point at those specific activities that are frontier enabling. In other words, those that help quantify resources, that help private companies get involved in creating an industrial infrastructure in space, that help lower the cost, that help change contracting methods from cost plus to actually pay for delivery, that help tear down barriers between communication between nations like ITAR. Focus on those and point those out to people in leadership positions in your nation. Another thing a person can do that is maybe a little more leveraging in a way at the same time is contact your opinion makers. Contact your favorite editorial writers and stay on them. I have a friend in Boston who David I'm sure has met, a guy named Charles Lurio.
Right.
Now, Charles is a brilliant fellow. He's not exactly going to be the first chair guest on Dave Leno. On Jay Leno, which is our American, you know, talk show. He's, you know, somebody who has incredible ideas. But what Charles did years and years ago, we began working with Charles, and what Charles did was in his home area of Boston, Massachusetts, he started writing to and calling the local opinion writers and editorial writers in the Boston newspapers and started sending them materials about this sort of frontier movement, sending them Space Frontier Foundation press releases, sending them quotes, sending them, I think even maybe even sent them books and things like that, like Dr. Jerry O'Neill's High Frontier book, or hopefully our Return to the Moon book, which I hope we can talk about in a minute. But began sending them. Basically, he grabbed their leg and would not let go. And through sheer tenacity, by staying at it, just an average guy, okay? I mean, a very smart average guy, but just a person, one person alone, made a difference because he stayed in there. He kept talking to them. He would interact with them, get them to talk back to him, and then he would engage them in a conversation. And through that conversation, he would feed in his point of view to the point where over time, we began to see slowly people in media, starting with Boston and then other media that he began to work with over time as he got more confident, begin to start echoing the language of the frontier movement. Anybody can do that. You can start with your local paper. Your local paper may go, well, this is about space and this is beyond anything that you know, our local farming community cares about. No, it's not. My family lives in rural Texas. I have gone down there and given talks to the local Kiwanis, which is a local group of people who get together for lunch once a week and sing songs and like these are community leaders.
Like a Rotary Club.
Like a Rotary Club, very similar. Some of these people are ranchers and farmers. I mean, some of them come in with dirt and manure still on their boots. To these luncheons, and they sit there, and they put me up a couple of times over the years.